Hi, Jim.
Hi, Bob. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm great. I'm great. I'm great.
Now, in the event that there's anyone on the planet who doesn't know who you are James Pinkerton, celebrated contributor to Fox News. And what else are you up to these days?
Way back when, I worked in the Reagan and Bush 41 White House domestic policy offices and floated around all those various presidential campaigns, including the 2008 campaign when I worked for Mike Huckabee.
Right. And
And you and I were colleagues at
is
the
he he's not done yet, is he?
I don't think so, no. Keep hope alive. And I think you and I were colleagues at the New America Foundation for quite some time.
Right.
Right. Where despite of our despite our mutual dry acerbic natures, we actually liked each other.
Well,
Okay, yeah, when I was there you had me fooled.
comes and goes. You know, I mean, for example, you know, I read what you say about this well-meaning French economist who wants to bring us closer to equality of something or other. Is his name Piketty or Piketty?
I have read Piketty as in P-E-E-K and then E-D, but I mean, to look at it as an English reader, you call it Piketty or something. As Piketty. We're talking to the same fellow.
And he's the you know, he's the talk of the town, and and you're not a big fan of his, apparently. His argument,
No, I mean, look, I think that something is going on in the world about financialism and over-financialism. I think, and so the argument that capital is drawing greater returns than labor, that's clearly happening in the last 30 or 40 years. So in that sense, he's on something. I wrote a piece for Breitbart News where I said, look, there's actually other causes that are going on. I mean, for example, the most obvious one is the internet. Jaron Lanier, who the founder of virtual reality, has a book a couple of years ago we just reissued in paperback called Who Owns the Future, where he sort of says, look, what the people who own the networks, and I'm talking about internet networks and server networks and so on, as opposed to, you know, TV networks, are the ones reaping the huge returns out of every transaction. I mean, if we're on Facebook, it's free to us, but Mark Zuckerberg winds up with the money. I think Mark Zuckerberg is a genius. He's also got $27 billion just to his own name. And so that phenomenon of inequality is even greater, it seems to me, than the income inequality. And so it would be a shame to follow Piketty's advice and the advice of Paul Krugman and Ezra Klein and so on, who are talking about 90% tax rates, only to discover that the real sources of inequality are much to do with the changing technology per linear.
But I don't see what it matters. I mean, isn't Piketty's own analysis that it's kind of built into the dynamics of the system at this point that left to its own devices, capitalism will increase the concentration of wealth and increase income inequality in the 21st century? I mean, you seem to be agreeing with him there.
I sort of am, except I disagree with him on solutions. I'm much closer to the arguments made, for example, by Mickey Kaus in a book 25 years ago called The End of Equality, where he said, look, this is Kaus 25 years ago prior to the internet, or at least the internet being anything that people
Right, and income inequality was already growing, by the way, but go ahead.
Exactly, it was, and his point was, he called it the Hollywood effect. This is, you know, back in the 80s, he's made the point that, you know, in 50 years ago, or you know, in the Cold War era, an American movie producer would sell movies to America and Europe, and that was about it. And in the era of globalization and the fall of the Berlin Wall, the same movie producer could sell movies to the entire planet. And again, he called it the Hollywood effect. If you're a star in America, you're a star in the world, and you can sell tickets. Now, of course, what's changed in 25 years has been Napster and so on. So the value of copyrighted material has fallen off, and the ease of which it can be transferred and peer-to-peer shared has accelerated, which means that the Hollywood effect no longer applies to Hollywood as much as Silicon Valley. Now that's Kaus 25 years ago. Just your own colleague Mark Schmidt had a piece for the New America Foundation in the last few weeks, where we talked about the word pre-distribution as opposed to redistribution. How do you build into the system such things as high wages, and that's an important issue, but it has very little to do with, I mean, this in my view, the standards idea of just simply raising taxes.
Well, what's so bad about raising taxes on the rich?
Well, I mean, I think that, first of all, we've been, I mean, I certainly think that getting rid of the carried interest deduction and so on, having rich people pay lower rates than probably you and I pay, I'm not in favor of that at all. Okay. I would change that, that's for sure. I certainly think in a world of high frequency trading, things like a Tobin tax on transactions is probably not a bad idea for lots of reasons, including just a social purpose of slowing down all this flash boy kind of stuff that Michael Lewis wrote about. Mm-hmm. But I worry, and I'm old enough to remember the 1970s, and I worry that a world of high rates stifles growth and stifles entrepreneurship and stifles capital formation and so on. So,
but it's not like the 70s came right after rates were raised, did they?
No, but the 70s came when people were, the world was starting to open up, and people realized that they could put their money in the Grand Cayman Islands or Luxembourg or someplace, get away from the U.S. tax rates and competitive pressures on rates, which continue. The average corporate tax rate of the OECD countries in the mid 80s was 50. Now the average tax rate for the corporate tax rate for the OECD countries is 25.
The 70s also came after a lot of deficit spending to support the Vietnam War and after oil prices skyrocketed. I mean, it's not as if there's some kind of consensus that tax rates were the culprit.
I think there is a consensus that tax rates since then have plummeted and the economies of the world have taken off.
Income inequality has grown. Right, well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Have economies taken off? It's not great economic time for anyone.
They sort of go together. It's kind of the point I made in the Breitbart piece is that economic activity is disequalizing. I mean, inherently. I mean, again, the growth of the internet has created new commanding heights. The genius of the people who led the fracking revolution in the teeth of opposition of the government, the oil companies, and the sort of the tyranny of the status quo. You know, people like George Mitchell and Harold Hamm have made themselves into billionaires by discovering that we probably have, you know, some multiple, you know, 10, 20, 50 times as much oil and energy as anybody thought.
And you think if their tax rates were five percentage points higher, they would not have done that?
I'm sorry?
And you think if their tax rates were 5 percentage points higher, they would not have done that?
Probably it wouldn't make a whole lot of difference, but I'll just remind you that Paul Krugman and Ezra Klein, who are two, you know, I mean, Krugman, of course, is a Nobel Prize winning economist, and, you know, Klein is the, you know, aging wunderkind, are talking about 90% tax rates.
The Overton window. You know what the Overton window is, right?
I do.
But they're moving it. Nobody's seriously thinking about 90% rates, although there was a time in American history, right, when was it? Rates were at one point 90%, right, in the 30s or something, or the...
in the 40s, 50s, and into the early 60s, they were 94 in World War II, and then in 91 after the war ended.
Well, geez, late 50s were good times. Unemployment rate way lower than it is now.
You're right.
I mean, this is the case for 94. You sold me. This is not just the Overton window. We need 90% tax rates. Thank you for making that argument so persuasively, Jim. Listen, I got to run now. Thank you.
maybe we could get away with it if it were not an option to move your money to China or Mexico or...
Well, there is that.
A hundred other places around the planet. I mean, if capital is completely trapped, then maybe you can get away with it. But don't
you have to kind of like move your citizenship?
Well, apparently not. I mean, apparently, remember the euro dollar market from the 70s? And that was, okay, well, back in the 70s, this is the kind of thing that caused the changes that happened. American dollar bills or dollars were accumulating overseas. And so there's a whole kind of parallel banking system created based on U.S. money that could not be repatriated back to the U.S., the idiocy of having two systems, an American system and a euro dollar system, became too painful or too ridiculous. So they eventually made it possible to put the banking system back together again. But right now we have a situation where American corporate profits, probably somewhere in the order of $2 trillion, are permanently offshore. Okay, they're permanently in places where there are lower rates than here in the U.S. And we want that money back or not?
But I do think there are two separate questions. One is, will people move money offshore? You're saying they can do it and, in effect, evade personal income taxes?
They can evade. Mitt Romney. I mean, we sort of went through the little opposition research exercise on him in 2012, and we concluded, I think, that he was paying about 13%, which is even below the carried interest rate.
We should change whatever laws he was exploiting then.
Okay, right. How did he do that? But he did it. I don't think anybody believes for a second that the people in the Forbes 400, whoever they are paying anywhere close to what Americans would think of are normal tax rates. And if you raise them, you have to answer the question of will this just increase evasion or will it actually collect money? And again, I think that if the goal is to increase growth without, then you have to think hard about how to increase growth. But I don't think that raising taxes will particularly help that.
Well, it may not help to increase growth. That's kind of a separate question. Although by your own account, I think this is in the other piece you wrote defending that crackpot rancher in Nevada, or maybe not explicitly defending him so much as glamorizing him and heroizing him and so on. But we'll get to that. Anyway, I think you noted that in one of these pieces, you noted that like total amount of stuff generated, has grown and as a result, middle class and lower income people even have access to all this technology. So, the total pie is growing, and presumably even if higher tax rates for the rich somewhat slowed the rate of growth, it would continue to grow at some rate, right?
Right. I did point out in one of those Breitbart pieces, again, I had just two pieces, one on Piketty, another one on Clive and Bundy, if income inequality is a staggering problem, it is a staggering problem with the strange dimension that even as things have become more unequal in terms of dollar terms, which is certainly the case in the last 30 years, it's also true that 91% or 90% of Americans have cell phones. Okay, that's up from zero 30 years ago. And 58% of Americans have smartphones. Okay, so they have access to tools that the richest person in the world couldn't have bought 30 years ago, or they could have bought whatever. What a cell phone 30 years ago, if they existed, was weighed 10 pounds, and of course had no internet surfing capacity or no apps or anything. So, I mean, it's a little bit precious to say that income inequality is the biggest problem you have when you and I are talking on technology that didn't even exist to speak of 20 years ago.
Yeah, although we know that the source of human happiness is more than absolute level of material wealth. In fact, once you pull nations out of out-and-out poverty, once you get per capita GDP to a certain fairly low level, subsequent GDP growth doesn't seem to bring much in the way of growth in actual welfare. And one of the things that does figure into happiness is that people naturally compare themselves to other people,
I guess my point is I'm more interested in maximizing freedom, including technological exuberance, than I am in sort of trying to calibrate happiness to the tax rate. I mean, I don't think it is possible for the American government or even for you and I to figure out what the tax rate is that will most make in Benthamite terms, make the most number of people happy. I think it's much more important to allow freedom and, frankly, capital accumulation, so that we can get on with the great work of, going to space, curing disease. I mean, there's big projects ahead of us that are much more important than making the Gini coefficient look right to the Beltway.
And what about, you mentioned freedom, what about democracy? I mean, don't you worry? I mean, I'm sure you'd already concede that rich people. I think there's a rich person at the door. My dogs are highly trained professionals. Democracy. I guess you'd agree that right now, wealthy people have disproportionate influence over the political process should they choose to exercise it. That's truer than ever in the light of two Supreme Court rulings over the last few years. And some individuals are really exercising it. I mean, I'm sure you are less concerned about the Koch brothers having influence than I am, maybe. But at any rate, regardless of the ideology of the people, wouldn't you agree that it's just kind of unhealthy for democracy if a relatively small number of people exert hugely disproportionate influence over political outcomes, which will happen to the extent the wealth accumulates?
Which is why it's so important. I mean, first of all, I don't worry too much about the Koch brothers. I do worry about Tom Steyer, the billionaire from San Francisco, who's apparently has sort of said publicly that he'll give $100 million to the Democrats if they stop the Keystone Pipeline, which of course they have. And I think that if this were a Republican billionaire going to a Republican party and saying, I need a regulatory decision from you, and if you give it to me, I will raise $100 million, give 50 and raise another 50 at $100 million total for you guys, I think the mainstream media would be talking about impeachment and criminal indictments hypothetical Republican.
So I favor a tax rate that would give both him and the Koch brothers less power.
Well, okay.
So I'm on your side.
I think it's perfectly possible to have high tax rates and still have all the problems of outsourcing and bleeding away the middle class and
those are different problems, though.
And military weakness.
There will always be problems. Yes, right? but outsourcing is a different problem.
I think that I worry that a higher tax regime would not solve any real problems and simply add on new problems. And I mean, for example, again, I associate myself with what Mark Schmidt wrote in that piece, you know, and I'm not sure he associates himself with me, but I would associate with him on, look, you need to figure out a way to rebuild the social contract, which is to say high wages. Much higher than they are now, expanded, non-funny money home ownership, free education, quality health care. Those sorts of things are needed, and we need to – I believe that all the billionaires in the world couldn't stop the middle class from achieving those goals for itself if the middle class was united in wanting those things.
So what is the cure? I mean,
I think that as I wrote in that Breitbart piece on Piketty, I said, look, in the old days, under very different political regimes, whether it was Federalist or Democratic or Whig or whoever's running the country, uh-huh. Through the Republican and Democratic duopoly of the 20th century. We had leaders who thought about infrastructure and thought about, railroads and interstate highways and thought about technological progress and R&D and curing developing the polio vaccine. Mm-hmm. And that kind of enlightened leadership confers public goods on the country. Jobs is what people really, really want. In Venezuela, you get the satisfaction of knowing that there's high tax rates and rich people are going to jail, but you yourself are still dirt poor and living in a world of crime. So I would rather focus on the fundaments of a strong middle class than get lost on the Piketty arguments of income redistribution.
One second while I tend to some business?
Okay.
Okay, so we're back. Why don't we just declare me the victory of the previous part of the discussion, and move on to something else briefly. I eventually want to talk a little about foreign affairs, because I assume you're worried that Putin is going to take over the world. But we could first talk about the piece in which you...
Let's talk about Putin first. Let's do Putin, okay. and then we'll come back to how to solve the Putin crisis.
Okay.
So I worry about Putin. I also worry about getting into a war over something we can't possibly defend. I think that America has a challenge of we have sort of committed ourselves to multiple containments of multiple enemies, probably more than we can manage. Okay, containment is a wonderful doctrine from George Kennan in the 1940s that worked against the Soviets. But now it seems to me that official U.S. policy is to contain Russia, China, Iran, global terrorism, and of course the dreaded CO2 molecule. We have five major containments we're working on, and I think that's probably more than we can manage. I bet you agree.
I think taken together, I think the Russia policy has been very inept. I think first of all, we just there's a failure to understand the way things look from other people's points of view. You know, Russia. These are areas, former parts of the Soviet Union, former parts of the Russian Empire in some cases fairly recent parts, that Russia had made it clear they felt very strongly about, which is not to say, I'm not defending what they did in Crimea or anything else, although I am saying that was no more a violation of international law than things we did when, for example, we invaded Iraq. Anyway, we need to understand what it looks like to them when, you know, they have a friendly regime in Ukraine and the government gets unseated, you know, arguably not constitutionally. I mean, the guy fled to save his life when there were armed militias roaming the city, A. B, that was preceded by our, a State Department official, Victoria Nuland, being recorded on a telephone call, kind of sounding like she was plotting to replace, like she was, you know, figuring out who was going to replace this president when we unseat him. And indeed, the guy she anointed wound up replacing him. So sure, from Russia's point of view, it looks a whole lot like an American plot. That's not a wildly surprising extrapolation on their part. And then the new parliament immediately votes to change the status of the Russian language in Ukraine to move it down a notch, and ethnic Russians find that hugely threatening. And then, of course, the president, you know, I'm sure after we made some phone calls, the president or prime minister or whatever, you know, vetoes the law or whatever the equivalent of that is. But still, you just have to understand that from their point of view, things looked very different than the way they look to us, which isn't to say that Putin is not a creepy thug, which he is.
I think we have to grant, if we don't want to, we'll have to anyway, that major powers around the world have spheres of influence. Yeah. Okay. And so if you want to play in their sphere of influence, you risk a war. I think the European Union has extended its sphere of influence eastward and crowded the Russians, and the European Union was negotiating long, you know, with Ukraine long before, I mean, not long before, but before, in addition to what the U.S. is doing. And they let their overeager bureaucrats in Brussels make arrangements, it would seem, with the Ukraine opposition, the Ukraine government, whichever, that the leading figures of Europe, Angela Merkel and whoever else, had no intention of redeeming. I mean, Germany was never about to go to war with Russia over Ukraine, whereas Russia was willing to go to war over Ukraine and probably still is. And so that kind of asymmetry speaks to what you were saying, that Russia's enormous interest in Ukraine and the Americas and the European Union's much less interest in Ukraine. And the solution all through history is you sort of concede to the other guys a certain degree of influence. How, you know, Finlandization was a phrase we were comfortable with all through the Cold War. It was just understood that Finland, which had broken away from Russia after World War I, and had fought with the Nazis against Russia in World War II, was never going to be a NATO member, and it was just not a good deal for them. They're bad luck that they were next to Russia and had that huge border. The Russians had tried to conquer them, and so it just was sort of understood that Finland was Finlandized. And I think the same thing is true of Georgia and Armenia and Ukraine and wherever else. And either we accept that, or we're looking at a war.
I don't understand why we don't get out ahead of this in anticipation of what is almost inevitable anyway. Say something like, look, if Russia will do X, Y, and Z, you know, including like vacate these buildings and so on, we will allow, you know, we are fine with, I mean, you have to get the government in Kiev to sign on to this, but in principle, we are fine with, like, internationally supervised elections in some of these eastern regions where you ask them, would you like more autonomy? Would you like to be part of Russia? Would you like to the status quo to remain, you know, some way of actually ascertaining the will of the people without any coercion going on and abiding by it. I suspect what you'd get is they want a great degree of autonomy, and that would threaten, in some sense, the integrity of Ukraine. But it seems to me it would lead to a stable outcome that probably made as many people happy as any other outcome. But we are like wed to this idea that it's no, there's going to be this struggle over Ukraine as a whole. And that's just not going to work. I mean, Russia has the capacity to make infinite trouble in eastern Ukraine. And they are, I don't think they're eager to invade, but they clearly have the capacity to calibrate it pretty precisely, I think, how much trouble they create without explicitly invading. And you just have to acknowledge power where it resides. I
agree. And look, obviously the Russians have figured out how to do this, non-marking, non-uniform, uniform soldiers and stuff and so on, and cutting phone lines and access and so on. And they have fifth columnists all over Ukraine. They've been studying this closely, for decades, I imagine. I'm sure Putin never reconciled himself to losing Ukraine as part of Russia / Soviet Union. And I'm sure the Russian army, the Red Army, feels the same way. If they're this intent on it, and we're unless we want to be equally intent on it, which is to say devote American blood and treasure to defending Ukraine, you got to kind of bow to reality. Now, having said that, I do believe that America has an interest in democratic elections and so on. So it seems to me the longer term project for the United States is to do to the Russians what Reagan did to the Soviets in the 80s, which is defund them by expanding American energy production. For better or for worse, we have put Estonia and the Baltic countries inside NATO, and it would be bad if NATO's credibility were destroyed by letting the Russians do to a NATO, Poland, for example, another example, do to them what they're doing to Ukraine. And so I think you can concede them some buffer areas like Ukraine and Belarus and maybe the Central Asian republics and so on. But you can't do it with NATO, and you can't do it with Poland, and you can't do it with Finland and so on.
Right. I mean, once you've signed a country up to NATO, and I was not in favor of all of the expansion of NATO, but once you've done it, you got to be serious, and you've got to make it completely clear.
Right. And that's why again I wrote another piece for Breitbart in which I pointed to a survey that got no attention at all from a group called the Institute for Energy Research, which says that the total value of oil and natural gas, not including coal, just oil and natural gas under federal lands and federal waters in the United States is $128 trillion with a T, $128 trillion. That's seven times the GDP of the country. It's 10 times the publicly held national debt. It's 30 or 40 times the government expenditures, federal expenditures. And I think that not only do I think we're crazy not to be using it, I think inevitably we will use it. But I think it's now the time is to continue the American economic renaissance through cheap energy and add on the geopolitical objective of pushing the price of oil down to the point where the Russians and our equally good friends, the Saudi Arabians and the Iranians and whoever else, no longer have the kind of economic leverage that they have. Thanks to cheap energy.
I agree that it's essentially inevitable at this point that the U.S. is going to tap enough of its resources to, in conjunction with other trends, drive energy prices down. And that's one reason that, look, Russia, I mean, why? It's just a declining power. Let's not freak out about it, because their economic base is eroding, which is the energy market. And, and these little sanctions we're doing.
Not eroding if the Greens in America get their way.
They're not going to get their way enough.
I agree with you, but 3 or 4 years ago, it wouldn't have been so clear. 3 or 4 years ago, when America came this close to passing cap and trade legislation, and
I don't know how horrible that would have been. But fracking is going to happen, and
if it does happen, then we have I think Americans will have to sort of step back and say, look, the world will look dramatically different if it does happen. Energy is input, and manufacturing will be much cheaper. Mm-hmm. Transportation will be much cheaper. Everything will be much cheaper. America will be autarkic on energy, which I think is a good thing. Let's. It would be nice to. I mean, I just saw some silly item flying by online. Some alleged think tank in this town is not New America, some other one, saying we need to have renewable energy for our military. Here we are, the world's greatest petro power, and we still put in motion these sort of, you know.
I actually like the idea of like people in the infantry with on their helmets. You know, there would be these solar panels extending about 6 feet up. Okay, imagine, picture this, Jim. This is going to work. Just stick with me here, okay? You got your helmet, you got your rifle, you got a solar panel that just goes about 6 feet up, is on your helmet, but it's camouflaged. Okay? What's wrong with that?
Yeah, what infantryman wouldn't want to be six feet taller on the battlefield? No,
exactly.
No, we're still the DC power. I was at the Barnes & Noble not long ago. And I found three books on the bookshelves about peak oil. Okay,
oil,
so the policy class has just sort of chosen not to acknowledge the fracking revolution, and therefore all our budgets and projections about Medicare and taxes and spending and the deficit and so on are still kind of in, you know, old pre-fracking mode, and it's just part of the challenge is to get people to say, no, wait a second, look, we're going to be in it. For better or for worse, and I think for much better, we're going to be in a different world where this kind of scarcity metrics that, again, you and I, Bob, are baby boomers, and we grew up all our lives hearing about, you know, Arab oil dependence and energy shortages and energy crises and all this kind of stuff and, you know, wearing sweaters. And now, again, thanks to some really, really brilliant Americans, all that calculus is out the window, and we ought to start thinking about what do we do with a few extra trillion dollars. And I would say missile defense comes to mind immediately as a good idea, not only for Russians, but also the Chinese.
We're moving into some areas. You know, we've had a little too much agreement, and I'm glad we're moving into some areas where you're crazy and I'm not. So we can highlight that contrast. I mean, there's missile defense. There's also the thing you wrote. I put this in the "You're Crazy, I'm Not" department, but tell me if I'm wrong, Jim. The other piece you wrote in Breitbart, where you were like turning the crackpot Nevada rancher into a kind of a hero, and you wrote, it was kind of a somewhat fanciful piece. You wrote that as if written from like 50 years from now, right? You wrote a piece that is supposedly written in the future, looking back on this Nevada standoff as this crucial like hinge point in history where finally. The menacing federal bureaucrats or something were faced down, and because of this guy Bundy and a couple of other things, there was this pivot, and the forces of goodness were empowered. So explain to me how this guy is not just a total crackpot. I mean,
he might be. I've never met him. He might be a total crackpot. The people behind the American Revolution were regarded as crackpots by enlightened British opinion in 1776, and they were, of course, proven to be great figures. And who knows how Bundy will be remembered in history? What I really dwelled on in the piece was the effort in Salt Lake City at about the same time, led by the Speaker of the Utah State House, a woman named Rebecca Lockhart, who were saying, listen, we want to take control of lands in the West from the federal government. And it is crazy, this is them talking, to have 50, 60, 70, 80, 90% of land in the Western United States owned by the feds. And they're doing it... They're doing it because they sort of inherited the land because nobody wanted it back in the days of the Homestead Act 100 plus years ago. And the government-owned land, which was sort of doing nothing, where the 50 years ago the government policy was, well, we weren't really doing – there's nothing really to do with any – it has no real economic value. But if somebody has a great idea for building a dam and building a hydropower station out of federal land, we're happy to do it. That was the policy. Then in the 70s, the policy shifted. The environmentalists, the Greens, got a hold of all this land and said, hey, wait a second. Here's our chance to preserve the American West in aspic, you know, in amber forever. So we're simply going to shift over the use of federal ownership to from reclamation, which is the Bureau of Reclamation at the Interior Department, to freezing it, as it were, forever. And that was sort of a moot issue, and nobody really cared that much. And there's a little sagebrush rebellion in the 70s and 80s that didn't really go anywhere. Now what's changed is that energy values are probably 100 times greater than they were 40 years ago, and also such things as rare earth elements, all these little elements that you with funny names like yttrium and lanthanum and scandium and so on, that not one American in 100 would identify or know where to find, but is vital, we discover, to cell phones and computers and batteries and so on. So and of course we're now importing a good chunk of our rare earth elements from our dear friends in China. Or getting them from conflict places like, the Democratic Republic of Congo. And so we've got it here in America, but it's all locked up by the environmentalists. And I think even you, from what you're saying earlier, would agree that it's ultimately going to get opened up because we need the money and we need the resources. Well, so my point about Bundy was, it will be remembered that Bundy and his grazing fees and taking on the desert tortoise was a hinge moment because
it seems to me Bundy is protesting exactly the thing that you are championing, which is the grazing deal is a case of the government seeing economic value in the land it holds, extract value in the form of grazing land, extracting the value and appropriately charging people in the private sector who profit from helping them extract the value. I mean, that would be presumably the model you'd favor in the case of rare earth elements or something. You don't want the government to just give the money to people, right?
They're also trying to put him out of business by declaring...
Well, that's because he wouldn't pay the grazing fees. That's his protest against exactly what you're championing.
They shrunk the land that you can use because they're protecting the desert tortoise. There used to be and there used to be 50 ranchers like Bundy, and he's apparently the last one in Clark County, Nevada. 5-0 to 1, they cut him by 99% because they've simply declared the desert tortoise to be more important. I think the desert tortoise is important. I wish it the best. That's what we have zoos for. That's what we have national parks as opposed to federal lands. What's happened, and again, something that has sort of snuck up on us without us realizing it, the national parks were created by President Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, back in the early 1900s to preserve endangered species. In the 1970s, when nobody was paying enough attention, the Endangered Species Act was enacted, and now the entire country.
But just to be clear, this guy's argument is that the government has no right to charge him for grazing on land the government owns, I gather, or else he's claiming falsely and speciously that the government doesn't own it or something.
Yeah, look, I'm not going to defend his particular case, I'll simply observe that. As has been written up a lot in the Nevada press, there's more going on there with the Bureau of Land Management and Harry Reid's protege, who runs a guy named Cronzy, who runs the place, pushing farmers off their land using the Endangered Species Act to create a solar central place out there, a solar city. That appears to be part of the long term.
That's the other thing where I got off the boat.
What I support is turning the land away from the BLM, giving it back to Nevada or to private ownership. And let's see how much fracking and rare earth elements there are under there. I suspect the result will be, if you prorate the 128 trillion, not including coal, to Nevada, I suspect the chance to turn everybody in Nevada into a millionaire, everybody, will be so tempting that the sort of the Malthusian hammerlock that the Greens have put on growth in the last few decades, is going to be broken. I look forward to that. And when it is broken, people will say, yes, Clive and Bundy might not have been our perfect hero, but he played a necessary historical function, sort of like the storming of the Bastille, in getting people to think, including the people in Utah mentioned before, Rebecca Lockhart, the Speaker of the House, to say, wait a second, we will use this wealth in a better way than leaving it there, where while we're all struggling over deficits and spending and Medicare and so on. It's crazy to be doing this. We don't have to. We can end it. An American abundance revolution, as I said in the Breitbart piece.
Although I would point out, if your premise is that the government is holding just tons of land that, that could otherwise make us fabulously wealthy. As one of the trends that has been afoot for, I think, centuries, if not millennia, is that less and less of the total economic value in the world lies in land.
Well, except maybe you're wrong, Bob. Maybe you're wrong. Maybe there's 100 times more mineral wealth than we realized. Maybe, again, there's a book by a guy named Zuckerman called The Frackers, which I'm reading right now.
Right.
He makes the point that these frackers in Oklahoma, like, you know, Harold Hamm and George Mitchell, not the U.S. Senator, the another George Mitchell, they're fracking now underneath Exxon's headquarters in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Exxon didn't see the economic value in fracking. Exxon's idea was we will just make a big deal with the Saudis or the, you know, the Nigerians or Texans or whoever, and buy big oil, Russians, that's a big example, and buy big oil fields and drill oil the old-fashioned way, you know, and these other guys, these sort of insurgents, it's sort of a story right out of Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead, have figured out some new way to do this with the fracking. And if you go to YouTube and just look at a video of how this happens, it's sort of mind-bending how hard it is, how complicated it is. If there's ever an epochal human achievement, it's what these guys have done. And they've simply realized value.
And they're doing it, and we agree it's going to proceed. So that seems not to be the case where the government is holding up.
Well, you know, the government is fighting it every step of the way. The Obama administration is, and Tom Steyer, the green billionaire, is fighting it. And because it's so fraught with conflict, we haven't started thinking about spending the money that we need to do things like rebuild our infrastructure and create middle class jobs. Again, in North Dakota, we're you know, fracking paradise. The starting jobs at a Walmart are $17 an hour. This is according to the Christian Science Monitor. So in other words, every progressive, every declared progressive dream about good jobs and good wages. Believe me, if the base pay of a Walmart were $17 an hour, we'd have the kind of big middle class that the progressives say that they want.
Although, I mean, you talk about, you know, having more wealth so we can rebuild infrastructure. You're opposed to actually doing the thing governments that would help a government rebuild infrastructure, which is raising taxes on the people who have all the money.
Oh, no, Bob, you rebuild infrastructure by spending money. Raising taxes is a second order thing. The first order thing is spending the money. And I'm saying I'm definitely for spending the money.
Are you for deficit spending?
Deficit spending doesn't really bother me, frankly, but I'm much more for borrowing against $128 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
That should be easy enough.
Okay.
All those Wall Street brainiacs could figure out what the future value of $128 trillion is, and it'll be a pretty big chunk of money, and we could fill every pothole in the country.
I'm in favor of that.
Okay.
Every pothole in the country. Anything else you want to opine on in hopes of?
That's it. I mean, again, I think I commend everybody that this Zuckerman, the Frackers. It's quite an entertaining book. Mm-hmm. There's actually several books on fracking out there. This is one I happen to find at the bookstore. And again, I do believe on the energy of the hydrocarbon thing. We need a plan for carbon sequestration. I'm not really convinced that global warming is real, and I'm certainly not convinced that human action is causing, as opposed to sunspots and radiation and so on. But I, as a compromise, as a goodwill gesture, I think we need an important program to secure a better carbon sequestration plan long term, in case it does turn out to be real. And as I mentioned in the Breitbart piece, I think we need avatar sized trees, thousand yard high trees. I think we need to take carbon landfill and make a new island out in the Pacific somewhere for it, new Hawaiian islands. I think you can do all these things, all these incredibly expensive research projects, which are sort of in the best tradition of can-do America. You can do all these things if you want to. You have to have the political will to pull it off. And I think we should do it. I think, Bob, you should join me.
Let me think about that. Can we get back to you in the next dialogue? Meanwhile, I want to say we will link to your two Breitbart pieces, including both the more crazy one and the less crazy one. And I want to thank you for engaging in this ideological contest with me and once again agreeing to play the Washington Generals to my Harlem Globetrotters. You know, you perform a valuable service here on Blogging Heads. And as a little time elapses, I will call you back for a rematch and give you a chance to get even. Hasn't happened yet, but it could.
Just give me a chance to recover, and I'm happy to do it.
I'll give your self-esteem a chance to recover.
All right, wonderful. Okay. Thanks,
Jim.